I'll explain some of the experiments that he's done in the course of my talk. Also we'll mention in the course of my talk some recent work being done by two graduate students at UT Austin. I like talking about this topic, which I've been interested in for a long, long time, because it's connected to very simple and yet very fundamental ideas in quantum statistical physics. And there's also many aspects of it that still aren't perfectly well understood, although that may not be too clear from my talk. So let me start at the very beginning, and here's about the very beginning. This is a copy of the letter about Bose statistics written by Bose to Einstein. Bose, as you all know, realized that he could explain Planck's black body radiation law if he assumed that many quanta of light were able to occupy the same state in doing the combinatorics of many photon states and, you know, applying the recipes of statistical physics. And so he wrote this letter, and leading to the charming story of asking Einstein to translate it to German, which he collegially did, and had it published in Zeitschrift for Physique. But it was actually Einstein himself who realized what is perhaps ultimately the most interesting property of systems with many, many bosons at a finite temperature. this is an equation written in Einstein's own hand from the University of Leiden Einstein Archive. You can see that even though Mr. Einstein was a very clever fellow, he had to check his equations very carefully. So I guess he decided this was correct, and most of us actually know this is correct, because this is a calculation we've all done of the density of particles, free particles, free non-interacting particles, satisfying Bose statistics that can live in finite momentum states at some finite temperature. And the most important property of this expression is the fact that the sum on the right-hand side converges. And what that means is that there's a finite density of electrons, of Bose particles that can have live in finite momentum states at any given temperature. And so, as Einstein realized, if the number of particles exceeds that, all of the remaining particles will go into whatever is the lowest energy state available to the particles. And for a macroscopic system, that means you have a macroscopically occupied quantum state, which makes quantum mechanics, brings quantum effects to the macroscopic world, breaks symmetries because you have to choose a phase for this quantum mechanical wave function, and can lead to observable interference phenomena of matter waves. And what is so most important for my property is that when you have macroscopic occupation of a quantum state, it leads to superfluidity. And superfluidity first observed actually in helium-4, and it was Fritz London who first suggested that Bose condensation might be the explanation for superfluidity, and indeed it is. So superfluidity is, of course, a flow of matter without any dissipation, and I'll talk a little bit more detail later about how that happens in my particular context. So this talk is not actually about Bose condensation or condensation of Bose particles. Instead, it's a condensation of fermion pairs. And in fact, the most important example of Bose condensation is probably condensation of pairs of electrons in a singlet state in common superconductors. So in a superconductor, electrons, of course, are fermions. They don't Bose condense, but if I make pairs of electrons, then they act like bosons, And they can Bose condense, and they do in superconductors. And superfluidity in this case is motion of charge or current flow without dissipation. It's the a closest realization I think we have in nature to real perpetual motion type machine. And so it's a very fundamental and interesting phenomenon. So I'm actually not going to talk about superconductivity. I'm going to talk about something that is a little different, although related, and that's condensation of electron hole pairs, where starting from some ground state or some vacuum, you have a system where you have you can have both electrons and missing electrons, both electrons and holes, and those electron holes can form pairs, and I'll discuss an explicit example in a moment, and those pairs act like bosons, and they can Bose condense. So as I'll mention towards the end of my talk, I'm actually going to talk about Bose condensation of a particular type of electron hole pair, which is called an exciton. But this is not really very different in a fundamental way from phenomena that sometimes occurs in certain types of ferromagnets or, to a certain extent, charge density wave systems. Okay. So let me talk a little bit about Bose condensation of excitons. This is actually a very, very old topic from a theoretical point of view, but a much newer topic from a experimental point of view. So excitons, as usually understood, are the elementary excitations of insulators, of, let's say, insulators or semiconductors. So let's imagine that's a common semiconductor crystal. And it has a vacuum, a ground state with bands of electronic states in the crystal full, a certain set of bands, the valence bands, full, and a certain set of bands in semiconductor physics, usually called the conduction bands, empty. And so you can make when you make an excitation, you promote an electron from this filled valence band to the empty conduction band, making an electron hole pair. The electron and the missing electron, the hole, have opposite charge, so they have attractive Coulomb interaction, and they form a bound state below the particle hole continuum. And that excited state of a system is called an exciton. Excitons can have any momentum. They're electron hole pairs. They can Bose condense. People have imagined for a long time, although it's been challenging to see that. One of the reasons it's challenging, you just saw, is that excitons have a finite lifetime. So as I mentioned, from a theory point of view, the idea that excitons could Bose condense has a very long history. As far as I know, this is the first paper in this topic, written by a couple of guys at NYU. I actually gave a talk on this topic at NYU last year, and I asked them whether they had any memory of these people, and they said yes. They actually left NYU not too long after this work was done. But one sentence of this early paper that's has been a part of the lore of exciton condensate is that excitons are electron hole pairs. Unlike Cooper pairs in a superconductor, they don't carry a charge. And so when they move, even if they move in a superfluid way, it can't move charge in and out of external circuits, and therefore you would not be able to detect this effect electrically. Okay? There'd be no spectacular electrical effects analogous to superconductivity associated with exciton condensation. So here's another famous paper from the literature on exciton condensates. This is a paper by Walter Cohn and David Sherrington. One time I was giving a talk on this topic a number of years ago at the National Magnet Lab, and somebody stood up in my talk and said, "But what about my paper?" And so that was David Sherrington. And so ever since then, I've included this slide when I talk about this topic. They said, okay, maybe you can have an exciton condensate, but it wouldn't even, you wouldn't be a superfluid, wouldn't have superfluid behavior. And so it turns out that actually, I'll show you, both of these statements are wrong. It's nothing like having real experiments to tell you what the truth is. But they're wrong for reasons that would have been very hard to anticipate back then, as I'll try to explain. Okay? So now I'm going to spend a few minutes talking about the type of system in which people have been studying exciton condensate, some of the strange, spectacular electrical effects associated with these condensates, and about how to understand some of these effects. So first of all, the experiments which have detected these exciton condensates are electrical. They're transport experiments. And these experiments really only work when you have equilibrium exciton condensates. Relative to some vacuum, you have lots of electrons and holes in different bands that are present in equilibrium. Okay? So it's not a virtual steady state. So the systems are two-dimensional electron systems with two layers, bilayer two-dimensional electron systems. The experiments I'll show you later are performed in systems where electrons can be confined to two different quantum wells. So red electrons, one confined to one quantum well, blue electrons confined to another quantum well. And the experiments are actually done in a magnetic field, which creates a convenient reference ground state, if you like, to count electrons and holes from. Because when you have two-dimensional electrons in a magnetic field, their classical circular cyclotron orbits produced by Lorentz force get quantized into Landau levels. So kinetic energy is quantized for two-dimensional electrons in a magnetic field. But there are many electrons for each quantum, for each quantized kinetic energy, because the electrons can do cyclotron orbits around different points in space. It turns out that the number of electrons in a Landau level, in these groups of states, is equal to the number of quanta of magnetic flux that go through the two-dimensional electron system. So we have electrons that are in layers, can be labeled by layer, perfectly localized in layer. And the situation we're interested in is the situation where the number of electrons in one Landau level is equal to the number of holes in another Landau level in a different layer. And you can imagine, under that circumstance, the electrons and holes form bound states. They do. And when you have many electrons and holes, they actually form an electron-hole pair condensate. I'm not going to go through the reasons that we know that, but let me just say that it's related to our understanding of the fractional quantum Hall effect and rigor with which the statement can be made that the ground state is an electron-hole pair condensate is greater than what we're normally able to provide. Okay, so it's a condensate of electrons, holes, hole pairs with electrons in one layer, holes in the other layer. So here's a transport experiment. I'm going to show you the experiment, And I'm going to explain the ideas that you need to understand this experiment, and then I'll show you the experiment again. So let me first just describe, you know, what's done here. So now this is a bilayer two-dimensional electron system. There are two layers, a green layer with this projector and an orange layer. And these different layers are separated by a barrier material so that electrons absolutely cannot tunnel from layer to layer. And a bias voltage is applied across a path connecting the outside and the inside of these rings of electrons. The reason they make these electron rings, I won't talk about in detail, but it turns out that it's advantageous for this phenomena to make these so-called Corbino rings of electrons. So a bias voltage is applied across the top, and what is measured is that a current flows through the bottom ring. That's just exactly opposite, okay? Even though they're electrically isolated. And let me just also say that this current flows only when you form, only when the number of electrons is equal to the number of holes. Okay, so that's the experiment. So there are really two ideas that you need to understand this type of experiment. The first is that when you form an electron-hole pair condensate, electrons can tunnel from layer to layer. So what I've written here schematically is an interaction between some density of electrons in the top layer, some density of electrons in the bottom layer. And when I have a coherence, when this electron-hole pair, spatially indirect electron-hole pair, involving a top, a bottom layer electron, let's say, and a top layer hole is formed, then this electron-electron interaction term develops a mean field proportional to the to this condensate expectation value. And the effect of that mean field term on quasiparticles, it allows them to tunnel, be destroyed in one layer and created in the other layer, to tunnel from layer to layer. Okay? So electrons, once you form this interlayer coherent state, the spatially indirect exciton condensate, you can scatter off, quasiparticles can scatter off the condensate and tunnel from layer to layer. This is true even though the number of particles is conserved in each layer. So this kind of mean field term is analogous to the famous pair creation and pair annihilation terms that appear in the mean field Hamiltonian of a superconductor, for example, and violating total particle number conservation. That may be familiar to many of you. Okay, so let me stick with that superconductor analogy to explain the second idea that you need to understand that transport experiment. And so let me just briefly remind you of an idea from the phenomena, the theory of superconductivity. So this is supposed to be a circuit containing a superconducting wire connected by, in red, connected by leads to the outside world that are normal metals that are in blue. So a normal metal can have quasiparticles near the Fermi level. Those quasiparticles carry current. A superconductor, it turns out, as most of you know, a superconductor has a gap at the Fermi level because the electrons form pairs and they're stuck in pairs, and it takes a finite amount of energy to pull that pair apart. So in fact, there are no quasiparticles at the Fermi level in a superconductor. And you might think that if I have some electron traveling through the normal metal and it runs into the superconductor, it would just be reflected. And in fact, that's right. That's what we call Andreev scattering. But it turns out that because, as I was just explaining, the superconductor breaks, in effect, breaks at a mean field level, breaks particle number conservation, an electron approaching the superconductor can be reflected as a hole. And so that process in which electron is reflected as a hole is known as Andreev scattering. And in order to restore, if you like, particle number conservation, what happens is that every time an electron from the normal metal reaches the superconductor and is reflected as a hole, it launches a Cooper pair into the superconductor, okay, to conserve charge. And macroscopically, what that does eventually is it takes the superconducting condensate and changes it into a state in which there's a flow of Cooper pairs. In other words, a state in which the momentum of the Cooper pair is not zero, or the phase gradient of the gradient of the phase of the Cooper pair wave function is not zero. In other words, it's an infinite momentum state. Okay? So that's a well-known phenomena in superconductivity. Current is carried in the normal metal by individual particles that scatter off this and that. When they reach the superconductor, that current is transferred via Andreev scattering into a current carried by the condensate itself, which no scattering can decay, essentially. So what happens in these exciton systems is just the same. The real Hamiltonian of the system has the layers speak to each other only by action at a distance, Coulomb interactions, strictly speaking, of course, by exchanging photons, but the in a normal non-relativistic description is just by instantaneous Coulomb interactions between electrons in one layer and electrons in the other layer. And what's going on in the experiment is driven by a bias voltage. A quasi-particle comes through a lead connected to the top layer. In the bilayer system, when the exciton condensate forms, there's an energy gap because all of the particles are in electron-hole pairs. It takes a finite amount of energy to pull that electron-hole pair apart. And so no quasi-particles, at least in zero temperature, can carry current from what's indicated here as left to right, but thinking of it as a 1D system, but in the experiment, this left and right are really the outside and the inside of a ring. No quasi-particles in here. If there's an exciton condensate present, every time electrons, first of all, can scatter off the condensate and provides a path for quasi-particles to go from the top layer to the bottom layer. And every time that happens, to restore particle number conservation, each of the layers, an exciton is launched. So the electrical bias voltage puts the exciton into a exciton condensate into a finite momentum current carrying state of exciton. So this is exactly what's going on in this experiment. It's the same transparency I showed you before. When if you take away this current loop or this wire that's connected, that has some resistance, that connects the outside and inside of the bottom layer, the layer that's not connected to the bias voltage, then essentially no current will flow from outside to inside through either layer. This system, in a normal sense, looks like an insulator, okay? But but once you allow current to flow, have a path for the current to close in the bottom layer, then in fact you're allowed to carry current from outside to inside in the top layer, inside to outside in the bottom layer by sending electron hole pairs coherently without dissipation through the system. Okay. So so there are actually a bunch of different, these two-dimensional electron systems buried inside semiconductors. Usually the easiest way to study them is by transport. So a bunch of transport experiments have been done. Every transport experiment gives strange results. And using those two ideas, I tried to explain to you all of these experiments can be understood in a common framework. And let me just mention one other type of experiment which requires an extra idea. Okay, and that's a tunnel experiment. So, you wire the system up so that current comes in. You inject current through the bottom in the top layer and remove it from the bottom layer. So ultimately, you're adding electron. If this current is flowing, you're always adding electrons to the top layer. You're always removing electrons from the bottom layer. So this is impossible if what I told you so far was really true. Okay, but I lied a little bit. And the way in which I lied is that, in fact, there is some possibility of electrons to go from one layer to another by a single particle quantum mechanical tunneling process. But the size of that effect can be controlled experimentally. It turns out that the way you can control it is by applying a magnetic field parallel to the direction between the layers, in-plane magnetic field. And you can get to the regime where there's absolutely no measurable tunneling between the layers. And the experiment I showed you before was in that regime. But you can also be in the regime where there's a little bit of tunneling. And let me try and briefly describe the transport in that regime using the following language. So, yep.
How small does the delta field on the
So, in an academic sense, people will often appeal to, actually, the answer is zero, right? But the real, that that answer would be so that would be the same as if I take a piece of iron and put it in the Earth's magnetic field. Iron's no longer a ferromagnet. So you have to answer that question in terms of individual phenomena. Does anything collective happen? And the answer is depends on what you're asking, I guess. But generally speaking, these interlayer tunneling things in these bilayers are always extremely small. So they're sort of like putting iron ferromagnet in the Earth's magnetic field. Okay, so here's one way to think about what goes on when I have interlayer tunneling. And so first of all, here I'm describing, this is basically the collective Hamiltonian of the bilayer system, just described in terms of the order parameter. The order parameter has an interlayer phase, and if you have tunneling between the layers, then the energy is lowered if the collective interlayer phase has a certain value. And there's a term that takes account of that. This is the kinetic energy of the exciton-Cooper pairs with some coefficient. And there's another term in the energy, which is connected to the fact that this is a bilayer electron system. So I have electrons in one layer, electrons in the other layer, If I add excitons, then it's like thinking of this bilayer as a capacitor. I'm charging up the capacitor more. And so you can characterize there's a term that you can characterize in terms of a capacitance, effective capacitance of some kind, which is describes how the energy changes when I change the number of excitons in the system. So the number of excitons here is written as M sub Z, and this is really reminding us of two things. One is that all of this is closely connected to magnetism. So M is normally the notation people would use for the order parameter of a magnet, the magnetization. And also, when I have this bilayer system, every state is a coherent combination of being in one layer and the other layer. It's some two-state electron system. And so you can describe that, to which layer degree of freedom as some kind of spin-like pseudo-spin and regard it as a magnetization. This is the energy anyway. Energy increases when I have more exciton kinetic energy, when I charge up the capacitor by making more electron hole pairs, and also I can have a term which changes the which prefers a particular interlayer phase. So this explicitly breaks the symmetry, which in the ground state is broken spontaneously. Now, here's a way of thinking about what happens when I have the tunneling current. This is a sort of semi-classical equation of motion for the number of excitons in this bilayer system. Okay? M sub Z stands for number of excitons in some units, the time rate of change of the number of excitons. And and there are a bunch of terms here, and this one is the if the gradient of the interlayer phase times some constant is the current of exciton, this is the divergence of the exciton current, and this is a process in which you can make and destroy excitons by in a collective way by coherently rotating electrons from one layer to another due to quantum tunneling. And so this looks very much like spin precession in a magnetic field proportional to delta. And then there is this exciton Andreev scattering term. And this is how currents flowing through this system influence the condensate by making excitons every time I inject an electron in the top layer, making excitons every time I remove an electron from the bottom layer. And so in the tunneling experiment, you're all the time injecting excitons into the system. And there are two possibilities. One is that that you can balance the interlayer tunneling term with the injected exciton. So this interlayer tunneling provides some sink of excitons. And if there's not too much current injected, you can sink all of the excitons you inject. But if the amount of current that's injected into the system is too large, then what happens is that you develop then the two layers start to look like they're electrically disconnected, which they actually are. And what that means, just from time-dependent Schrodinger equation, is the phase difference between electrons in the one layer and the other layer becomes time-dependent. And that will drive some kind of incoherent tunneling current through the bilayer. So that was probably too quick, but maybe you caught that there were two regimes. The blue curve here is a tunneling experiment, shows a typical tunneling experiment result. And what you see is that if you have this along this axis is basically an electrical bias voltage trying to drive electrons through the system. And at the beginning, you see some resistance. This is really the resistance of the external circuit, because I have the bilayer is coherent. And so there's the two layers are like two atomic layers that are, you know, adjacent to each other. And there's no resistance to go from one to the other. When you go, when you try to put too much current in, you get into this incoherent regime. And there's an extra resistance, which is the sort of tunneling resistance that you would calculate in a usual theory of tunneling. Tunneling resistance going from one electron system to another through an insulator. And so the resistance goes up. That's actually potentially interesting effect. I'm looking for a clock. So I guess I have one here. Okay, fine. We start at 5 after or so. Yeah. Okay, so so the red curve here, so this is a tunneling experiment, except it's with this Corbino ring. And there are two ways of driving a tunneling current from the top layer to the bottom layer. You can do it at the outside of the Corbino ring or the inside of the Corbino ring. And the red curve is actually a set of data taken by varying the current flowing, the tunneling current that flows between the layers when you apply a bias voltage at the inside of the Corbino ring. So initially, there's not much resistance, a lot of current flows, and then you go into a different regime, which is indicated by the red line here. Now, fell off the bottom of the slide here, but this is the current flow, tunneling current flowing from top to bottom, I2, plotted here, not against the bias voltage, which is driving it, but is plotting against I1. And so the point is that once you exceed the critical current, go off the vertical part of this curve, and you have a real voltage difference between the two layers, it drives current from top to bottom, a tunneling current, equally well, more or less, with the outside context and the inside context. And the black curve and the blue curve are the same thing. What's being varied is the bias voltage on the inside. And what's plotted, the resulting current is plotted against the current flowing at the outside. And so the difference between the red curve and the blue curve is that there's also a bias voltage at the outside. Okay. So the point of this is, first of all, the critical current is not determined by how much tunneling current flows from top to bottom at outside or inside, only how much current is flowing from top to bottom altogether. So because both outside and inside circuits are connected to the same condensate, there's a non-local relationship between the IV at the outside and the IV at the inside, even though they're electrically isolated. And what's more, the sharpness, if you look at this as a function of driving voltage, the sharpness of these IV curves is substantially smaller than KT, okay, than the thermal energy. So this is actually a very attractive set of properties from the point of view of electronics. I think most of you realize that progress in speed of electronic devices quietly stopped 5 years ago or so. Moore's law has come to an end, and it's come to an end because basically too much power is consumed in switching inside circuits. And too much power is consumed because in order to switch a current path for an individual electron, you have to drive it with a bias voltage that's much bigger than KT, because in effect the energy, each electron has an uncertainty in energy of KT, so you have to push it over a barrier with an energy much bigger than KT, in practice around a third of a volt. And in order to switch so you need a third of a volt that just gets dissipated, okay, every time you change a switch, and you have to have some number of electrons to do this so that there won't be too much noise in the circuit, so the system will know that, you know, the switch has, that some capacitor gets charged up. So that means you need at least dissipate this third of a volt for at least 100 or more likely 1,000 electrons. And that's too much to do things much faster than in the devices we have now. And so it would be, the only route, I think, for a real progress in electronics is have some kind of switch which acts not on a bunch of individual electrons, which together carry some classical information, but to have a switch that's collective in character. And the reason these IV curve features can be so sharp is because this is some kind of a collective electrical switch. And so my engineering friends are interested in this, and they taught me some things about the world of engineering. So one of the things they taught me is every time you make up a circuit, you have to make up a set of initials that go with it. And so they made up this set of initials that stands for bilayer semiconductor field effect transistor. And in principle, you can make a logic circuit based on these kinds of electrical characteristics that consumes orders of magnitude less power than current electronics. And there's only one problem with all of this. I'm not a wealthy person, actually. And the reason I'm not a wealthy person, because everything I told you happens below 100 millikelvin. And so we have a project trying to find this kind of physics at room temperature, and the rest of my talk is going to be about that. Okay. Okay, so how do we get to room temperature? Well, one idea we had was to use two-dimensional electron systems that are not in semiconductor quantum wells, but are made out of a single layer of material. And of course, experimentalists over the last decade or so have gotten very good at this, making these single atomic layer two-dimensional conductors. The best understood one is graphene. This is the Nobel Prize work of Andrei Geim and Kostya Novoselov. And people have made lots of progress on making single atomic layer sheet conductors. Graphene is actually a semi-metal. That means there's no gap between the conduction band and the valence band. So that means it's exceptionally easy electrically to make extra states in the conduction band of one layer of graphene, missing states in the valence band of a nearby layer of graphene. You can make lots of electrons and holes, and you can hope that because the Coulomb interactions are so strong in these two-dimensional materials, as I'll mention again in a moment, that something will happen at high temperatures. In fact, we don't know how to do any kind of control theory for this type of thing, and nature has sadly told us that, our experiments have sadly told us that nothing happens. Okay? Nothing happens that can be measured. Try again. Another prospect represented by this cartoon. This is not a proven false by experiments yet. The idea is this. We make the system simpler. We make the simple system simpler by making, using the idea of having two-dimensional materials, a single atomic layer thick two-dimensional materials, but we make them semiconductors. So what does that do? It creates an energy gap between the, that separates these empty conduction band states in one layer on left here, moves it far away enough in energy so that these degrees of freedom simply don't matter, the degrees of freedom in these remote bands. And so that means if I can generate a situation like is illustrated here, where I have a few holes, a few missing states in the valence band of one two-dimensional semiconductor close to states in the conduction band of another two-dimensional semiconductor, then I have electrons and holes, okay? Few electrons and holes. That's all only degrees of freedom I have. And that problem is much simpler because we know exactly what happens when we have one electron and one hole in this kind of situation. They form an exciton. And they form a bound electron-hole pair. And if I have some finite density, then those excitons can both condense. These are the materials we're thinking of. This is a family of two-dimensional materials that experimenters are getting better and better at. It's molybdenum disulfide and tungsten disulfide might be one combination. What's shown here is possibility of inverting the bands of conduction band and of molybdenum disulfide and tungsten ditelluride. But you know, one of the things that's nice about two-dimensional materials is that we live in three dimensions and we can manipulate them electrically so that we can move these guys in energies if they're in one layer relative to these guys, so you can easily make the bands cross. Okay, so this is a phase diagram. I'm going to try to explain now. This is trying to do a series calculation of what happens when I have a two-dimensional semiconductor like molybdenum disulfide close to another two-dimensional semiconductor by molybdenum ditelluride, separated by this two-dimensional barrier material, boron nitride. And I won't talk about this in detail, but this what this is indicating is you can electrically shift the chemical potentials of the two layers relative to each other. And what's indicated by this line here is when this relative chemical potential is effectively a spatially indirect gap is made smaller than the energy to bind a single exciton, then you start introducing excitons into the system. And those excitons will both condense, and there's some kind of interesting phase transition that I'll come back to in a moment within this exciton system at large layer separation. Okay. So this is an actual calculation of the excitons as a function of exciton momentum. Exciton energies as a function of exciton momentum in one of these two-dimensional semiconductors. Some of you may be aware that there's been a lot of experimental work looking at the optical properties of these materials. The excitons are very unconventional. What's important for us is that the binding energy within a single layer of an exciton is immense compared to the semiconductor quantum well case. It's bigger than a half a volt or so in these materials. Another interesting thing is there are many exciton states that have more or less the same energy. There are because of where the band extrema occur at symmetry-related points in the Brouwer zone. And It turns out that there are more or less 8 lowest energy excitons that are degenerate. So there are lots of flavors of this exciton, which if people create exciton gases in this system will allow quite interesting physics to explore. So this problem of gases of fermions with attractive interactions is very well known. As I mentioned before, the very dilute limit is extremely simple. It's just a two-particle problem, one electron, one hole. When you start to have more excitons, you can describe it using a mean field theory. And in the mean field language, what happens when you have many excitons is that in a condensed state, is that the dressed, you know, the broken symmetry quasiparticles, instead of being valence band states, have some coherent mixture of conduction band states in, and that contributes to the gap. So this is the BEC-BCS crossover problem that many of you know. The main thing I want to say is that even though in the high exciton density limit, it's hard to do things rigorously. It's a well-studied problem that people think they understand pretty well. Maybe I'm going to need to skip this, but let me just mention that beyond a certain layer separation, it turns out that the interaction between two excitons that have the same flavor is less repulsive than the interaction between two excitons that have different flavors. So for that reason, once you're beyond a certain layer separation, even though the system has many types of excitons available to condense into, it will choose just one and condense into just one, which, if this is seen, will lead to some very, very interesting magnetic properties. Okay, so I think I'm nearly at my second last slide now. I wanted to make a comment about, okay, so this is something. I'm going to make a few comments about fluctuations around the mean field state in this exciton condensate. This is actually related to trying to do the best job one can at estimating the temperature to which this exciton state survives, which is the, you know, is the $64 trillion question. Let me not comment on that. Let me just make a few comments about fluctuations of a condensate. So this system has an order parameter. The order parameter is the electron hole pair condensate. It's a boson order parameter. I wanted to make a remark about its relationship, as I understand it, to a famous boson that's in the newspaper recently, which is the Higgs boson, as well as to related properties of superconductors. So we can look at small fluctuations around the mean field state in this system. We can look at it in a harmonic approximation. And basically, you can think of this harmonic approximation in terms of starting with the mean field exciton condensate state and allowing mix in transitions from the occupied to the empty quasiparticle band. And we know how to quantize the fields associated with those. And you can separate the energy associated with the fluctuations in terms of energy fluctuations in the density of excitons and fluctuations in the phase of the exciton condensate. And so there are lots of excitations. These high energy excitations are really connected with the continuum of particle hole excitation. There are actually several things plotted here. One is the eigenvalues of the quadratic form, which describes how, in a harmonic approximation, how the energy depends on the density of excitons. Another is the eigenvalues of the quadratic form, which describes how the energy depends on phase. And you can see that there's one eigenvalue, which the phase energy goes to zero, like k squared, when the wave vector goes to zero. This is the normal Goldstone property that you can, the phase is, interlayer phase is spontaneously chosen. There's no energy associated with changing the interlayer phase globally, but there is an energy associated with changing the exciton density. And it turns out that the way this gets quantized is that for small fluctuations, phase and density are canonically conjugate. So roughly speaking, the collective modes are energies are given by the geometric mean of these eigenvalues and these eigenvalues. And my understanding, there's a number of, there's a very entertaining paper written recently by Chandra Varma about Higgs in condensed matter physics. Everybody wants a Higgs analog in condensed matter physics. The analogs people can make are never perfect. And so what you call a Higgs maybe is a little bit uncertain. But my understanding is that in Phil Anderson's early work connected, which played an important role in the development of Higgs boson ideas, he pointed out that there was no Goldstone mode in a superconductor. And the reason there's no Goldstone mode, the reason there's no Goldstone mode in a superconductor is that the energy, because of the long range of the Coulomb interaction, the energy associated with Cooper pair, with density fluctuations, diverges at long wavelength and compensates for the phase energy going to zero at long wavelength. So what would be the Goldstone mode basically appears at the plasma frequency. And so the plasma frequency, actually, you can't describe that using a field theory language because it appears at high frequencies. And there's another so one answer is Higgs for a superconductor is a plasmon, which is not an interesting thing. And there's the Higgs for this system for a superfluid is really just the phonon mode of the superfluid. But there's another thing that, in particular, Chandra Varma likes to call a Higgs, which is a collective mode which has a large weight a big residue for fluctuations in the magnitude of the order parameter. And it turns out there is such a collective mode here just hanging around just below the top of the particle hole continuum. It's kind of subtle, but whether this gets lost in the particle hole continuum or exactly what happens to it. But in superconductors, for example, one of the big issues with this is how can you ever couple to that mode? Because what directly couples to the order parameter is a physical operator that changes the number of electrons in the system. And that doesn't exist in a superconductor. And whereas here, this Higgs-like collective modes here in these bilayer electron systems, we can couple to because we actually control the interlayer tunneling processes, which could change the number of excitons in the system. Okay, one sec. I want to mention that if all this fails, and really whether we don't know if you can get to room temperature, I think you can get to rather high temperature, But the bigger question is probably the quality of the materials. Can they make really uniform systems of this type, which would be necessary to see this physics? So, but there is another type of way of seeing closely related to phenomena, and that's in real magnetic materials like permalloy or some real practical magnetic material. It's probably not something that everyone is aware of, but progress in being able to make very small nanoscale magnetic systems with designer properties has been incredible over the last 15 years. And nowadays, it's possible to realize a magnetic analog of this, which will certainly occur at room temperature. The challenge, actually, is to get small magnetization damping in the magnetic materials. And my engineering friends have a name for this, too. They call it a BISMAT, and I don't know what BISMAT stands for, and I will stop there. So thank you very much for your patience.
Questions?
Two short questions. One is your current voltage characteristics reminded me of Josephson-like critical.
Is there any? There is an analogy to Josephson effect. Josephson effect, of course, the phase that appears is the difference between the phase of one superconductor and the phase of another superconductor. And the current that's involved is the current flowing from one superconductor to another superconductor. But certainly the equations are rather similar. Here it's an absolute preferred phase, not a preferred phase difference. So there are some differences in the phenomenology associated with these, but certainly the semi-classical equation of motion is just the same.
Second question is, some times earlier, optically pumped excitons and their condensation was very popular. They were trying to get it at room temperature. What is the status of that?
So there are two different statuses. So one is without optical cavities and with optical cavities. Okay, let me talk about without optical cavities first. I think the very best work on looking for Bose statistic effects in many optically excited in systems with many optically excited electron hole pairs is by Leonid Butov at UCSD, and he sees lots of things which he interprets as reflecting Bose statistics of these exciton particles. Some other people are skeptical, and the reason the experiments are a little tough to interpret is you shine on a laser, you make a big bunch of these spatially indirect excitons, which are a bunch of electric dipoles with their dipole moments parallel. So they have repulsive interactions. And as soon as you make them, they start flying away from each other. And so that makes the phenomena you observe sometimes a little bit complicated. People are making a lot of progress on using strain or something to confine these excitons. And so I think that is making progress. In the case where you bring an exciton into resonance with a cavity mode of an optical cavity, vertical cavity, then this is what people refer to as polariton condensates. And so it's sort of an exciton condensate, but the exciton involves both the photon mode and the exciton. So you can view it as sort of an unusual kind of laser, which has matter coherence as well as light coherence. And so those steady states, if you like, or those systems with where Bose statistics plays a very important role have been heavily studied for the last 10 years or so. Lots of beautiful things being done. I'm actually trying to, connect some of these ideas that I tried to explain that we understand from quantum Hall systems to the polariton condensates, because it might be possible to make new kinds of electro-optic effects, which are related to the transport phenomena I was talking about earlier.
Thank you.
In relation to your remark about the fate of electronics, so you think that, you know, non-collective, let's say topological transport phenomena like quantum anomalous Hall effect and quantum spin Hall effect have really no chance to save electronics?
I think that's a real chance. So quantum anomalous Hall effect or quantum spin Hall effect, of course we have to find a system where we have let me go back to one of my, okay. So the reason they do these experiments with rings is because in the quantum Hall regime, you have chiral electron states that make basically the outside here always an equipotential and the inside always an equipotential. So that equipotential property, the fact that there's no dissipation even as current flowing along the outside here, that's connected to, you know, topological aspects, as you were saying, of quantum Hall effect. And if you could get quantum Hall effect or quantum spin Hall effect to work at room temperature well, then my engineering friends say that's actually serious. Because you can connect, you know, a bunch. It's really all about, you know, sort of what fan out. And you have a bunch of places here measuring voltage, and you measure the same voltage everywhere. So that's a potentially very powerful. But so that's a very interesting thing to think about from the point of view of applied physics. How can you get quantum Hall type of phenomena to occur at room temperature? We don't know how to do it right now.
Next question. OK, then let's thank the speaker again.
Okay, thank you.